Okay, it's a pleasure to introduce Ari Gordon, who is a PhD candidate in Islamic Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Ari received a bachelor's degree in philosophy at Yeshiva University. He received a master's of theological studies at Harvard Divinity School, where he met his wife, who happens to be lecturing across the hall. And it's a pleasure to have him and to welcome him. There's a wonderful generation of young scholars up and coming, and like the advantage, I think in that sense, the future of the Jewish people is strong and solid with all the young people and the young couples involved in Jewish learning in so many different areas. And I think this is a very interesting area. The relationship Jewish and Islam obviously is perhaps the most important issue facing the Jewish world nowadays. I mean, I can't really think of anything more important, how we're going to, you know, come to terms with this Islamic study. So, Vakasha, I won't take any more of your time.
Is this recorded without the microphone? I don't know if I need the microphone.
Yeah, I need the mic.
Okay, sure. Good morning. So I want to begin with a story, and then I'll give some framing and qualification remarks. But the story is something I experienced while I was studying Arabic in Jordan, in Amman. I spent a couple months there along the way in my studies. And something that happens, you know, when you go to a foreign country and you're studying the language is you get very good at what I would call, you know, taxi language, cafe language. What I would call my taxi Arabic got really good. You know, between my apartment and the school I was studying at, there was X amount of time, and during that time, you learned how to fill it with conversation, and there's a certain flow chart you build in your head. And so my flow chart looked something like this. I'd get into the cab, I would say in Arabic, you know, where I was going, Dor al-Awwal, Qasid, Merkaz Qasid, whatever it is, and they would look at me a little funny, because I was not wearing a kippah, I would wear a hat in the street. But they looked at me funny because I didn't look like one of their compatriots. And they said, "So where are you from?" We would have the conversation in Arabic. And I'd say, "You know, I'm from Philadelphia." And this was my opportunity for a joke. Not Amman, which used to be called Philadelphia many, many years ago. And Amman, you know, everything, building companies, cafes, they were called Philadelphia because Amman was called Philadelphia by the Byzantines. So we would have a nice laugh over that. And they would say, no, but what are you doing here?" I'd say, "I'm here to study Arabic." And they said, "Oh, so you're Muslim." And now it made sense for them. And I said, no, I'm not. And the conversation went on. One version of this conversation went like this. And I realized this is the way I wanted to have it after this. They said, "So you're Muslim." I said, "No, I'm not Muslim." I said, "Ah, are you Christian?" I said, "No, I'm not Christian." And the next question that I would have expected them to ask, I never got asked directly, "Are you Jewish?" I don't know if it's because a person couldn't have imagined that would be the person sitting next to them speaking to them in Arabic, or if it was not a polite question to ask, something like that. But they would say, "So what are you? What are you?" And at some point, I came up with the answer. I said, "You know, I practice the religion of Abraham, like so many Americans," is what I said. And they would look at me and sort of say, "Okay, so you're a Hanif," is the word. And we'll get into what that means, sort of anonymous monotheist. I had this conversation with a barber, actually at a place called Salon Beit al-Maqdis, the Beit HaMikdash hair salon. Beit al-Maqdis is an Arabic name for Jerusalem. And the two of them started arguing, "Oh, so Abraham was a Muslim." He said, "No, Abraham was this term, Hanif." And it was a back and forth. And I realized there's something here. And I have been studying Quran and I study Islamic history, and what I want to talk about today is this notion of Abraham, of biblical figures that are there in the Quran, of shared narratives. Before I start, I want to say a couple things that I'm not speaking about, just so that you are forewarned. When we talk about Muhammad, when we hear that name, when we say Islam or Muslim, it carries a lot of weight, with good cause for us as Jews. It carries a lot of weight, and sometimes fear, sometimes it conjures up terrorism and difficult ideologies, histories, a whole conversation just from this one word. So I want to tell you a couple things that I'm not going to be speaking about. I'm not going to be speaking about the entire history of Muslim-Jewish relations, the status of minorities, dhimmis under Islam. That's a different class, a really good one. The upshot in my reading of it is that depending on when and where a person lived as a Jew under Islamic rule, your life looked very different, and that the attempt to use contemporary realities or contemporary hopes to project onto the past, whether it's a golden age or a lachrymose picture of Jewish history, both of these are abuses of history, and we need to look at what's in front of us. That's the upshot of that. That's not this class. This session is also not talking about violence in the Quran, jihad. I have a session on that. Also very interesting, a complex topic. Not what we're doing today. We're not even talking about those verses in the Quran that deal specifically with Jews. We'll mention those in passing. There's a variety of those. Some of them are kind of troubling. Don't take Jews or Christians as your friends. Fight the unbeliever until they submit or are humbled. And there are also those that are more pluralistic. God gave everyone their own direction towards which he turns them. So struggle together in good works. Some formulation like this comes up a bunch of times. The Quran is a complicated book. What we are doing is talking about those shared narratives, about 20 or so biblical figures from Adam and Adam's sons. Moses is probably the most mentioned character in the Quran. Abraham, second at about 245 mentions. And we're going to try to piece together what it means to share narratives and to share figures with another religion, specifically here, Judaism and Islam. So if you think, and this is the disclaimer, if you think that it will be difficult for you to read Quranic passages, talk about Islam, hear about Islam, without directly addressing those topics, if that's going to be frustrating, this is not the session for you. There's a wonderful session with a wonderful teacher across the hall, a different take on Avraham, and there's no hard feelings. I would recommend that. What? If you'd like. But we are talking about what it means to share narratives with another religious community. And I think off the top, we'll talk about a few lenses, but there are a few possible responses just intuitively that we could think about. This is something I think about quite a bit. We could say it means nothing. I'm right and they're wrong. As you'll see from the New Yorker cartoon on the last page of the source sheet, the I'm right, they're wrong approach. It's not my approach. I don't think about right and wrong in these terms. I think there is a space for a debate about truth and the past and faith, but that's a different area. When we talk about a life of faith and what it means to us as Jews and as believers, the I'm right, they're wrong, I don't care about shared narratives. That's the whole premise of this class would be null if that was the approach we were taking. There are those who take the approach, which is, I think, on the opposite end of the spectrum. We're all people of religion. This is wonderful. And I want to say that it's wonderful no matter what, because we should be grabbing onto all possible commonality that is out there, regardless of where we find it and what it looks like. And we should say these are all bridges. I think that there's some truth to this as well. I think there's obviously, when we share narratives, there's something we have to say and believe. But this is also not my approach, because I think difference is important. I think meaningful difference is some of what makes us unique as a community, and it's some of what fuels us. So this is not my approach as well. You know, some of how I come at this is as an interfaith professional. Some of the work that I do is for American Jewish Committee and their interfaith, interreligious affairs department. I speak to different visiting groups from the Middle East, to Jewish groups about other religions, Jewish-Christian relations. And as an interfaith professional, it's obvious to me that I need to figure out something to say about this question. You know, there's a joke that's familiar to Jews involved in interfaith relations, you know, so a very narrow subset of what we're talking about. But, you know, the rabbi, the imam, and the priest or minister are on a panel, and the minister gets up and says what he says, the imam gets up and says what he says, and the rabbi gets up and says, you know, it's wonderful to be here together, Between the three of our religions, we're roughly a third of the world's population. And the joke is, you know, we're a minor decimal point there, 0.001, and we're talking about billions. Okay, you didn't find it to be that funny because you're not Jewish interfaith professionals. Rabbi Luchstein loved it, I could tell. But the fact is that there has never been a time in Jewish history when we've been able to have this kind of equal representation. And one of the things we need to appreciate, and I believe very strongly in the 21st century North American Jews, we must appreciate the opportunity that we've been given to sit as equals, and in fact, in representation that is much greater than our numbers in interfaith conversation. I don't think that everybody needs to be doing this work, but we need to be thoughtful about how we do it and to take it as something that we're grateful for with Hakarat HaTov. Just studying the long travails of Jewish history, it's a unique moment. So three lenses for thinking about the question before we jump in. And the three lenses are those that I come at it with personally. This is very much one person's take, and if I'm successful at what I do this morning, you'll either agree and be inspired or disagree very strongly and be upset, but either way, you'll go on and want to read more. The three lenses that I look at it with are those of a historian, of an interfaith professional, and as an individual, as a Jew. As a historian, I want to ask the question, what do shared narratives tell me about the context of contact? What does it tell me about the emergence of Islam and its relationship with Jewish and other communities that were around it? As an interfaith professional or someone thinking with the lens of interfaith relations, I want to know, does this help or harm? How can this be a tool or a hindrance to the work of building bridges between religious communities, so important these days? As a Jew, I ask a question where I don't really know the answer, and something that I check in with myself on regularly. Can I learn anything about my own faith, about my own practice, by studying that of another tradition? Is there something that can contribute to my own identity building? So those three lenses, we're going to look at a couple of three different pairings of Midrash and Quranic passages, and we're going to talk about them a little bit. So the first pairing, the first lens, again, history, interfaith, and Jewish identity, let's say, or Jewish religious approach. So for the history, I want to give us a little framing before we dive into the first set of texts. Does anyone know when Muhammad lives, his said to be born, prophesy, and die? Right? I heard 570 is given as a traditional birth date for him. First prophecy around 610. His career starts in the Arabian city of Mecca. And at some point, about 622, goes with his community to Medina, a town about 20 kilometers to the north, 20 or 50 kilometers. Some of the numbers are a little off for me. But I want to talk a little bit about what was happening in Arabia at that time. So if you picture the map in your head, I think when we look at the Middle East, we know where Israel is, we can see where Iran is, we can see where Africa is. Arabia is south of Israel. If I'm traveling east, I'll hit Jordan, Iraq, Iran. South of that is the Arabian Peninsula. And it was between two empires at that time, the Byzantine Empire with Roman culture and the Persian Empire, mostly a Zoroastrian kind of practice, but a conglomerate of a bunch of different states. And Arabia was a battleground sometimes between these warring empires that had weakened one another and themselves over centuries of fighting and vying for land and for position and for cultural dominance. And so Arabia, like many of the states in the Middle East, were vassal states where there were rulers who had a certain amount of autonomy but paid obeisance to one of the two cultures, one of the two empires and regimes. And it is in that context that Muhammad emerges as a prophet for his community. Now, in Arabia, they knew about prophets. We know that there were some version of Christianity in Jewish communities out there. We'll talk about what that may have looked like in just a bit. But they also had soothsayers. There was also Arabian pagan religions. There were poet prophets who would talk about things to come. And the story that Muslims tell, the traditional narrative, is one in which Muhammad was born illiterate to one of these prominent pagan families in Mecca, which was one of the centers of pagan practice around the temple, the Kaaba. Maybe you've seen pictures of pilgrimage, that black cube with the foundation stone, a rock of some kind inside of it. And he was a spiritual man who would go out into the hills, into the mountains, and one month a year would meditate. And then during one of these journeys of seclusion and meditative prayer, the angel Gabriel came to him. He didn't know that it was Gabriel. But he felt something grab him and said, read, ikra. You can hear the Hebrew word kara'a, also kri'a, like Quran. Ikra, read. He said, what should I read? Or I don't read, depending on the version you're talking about. He said, read. He said, I don't read. He said, read, ikra bismi rabbika ladhi khalaqa. This whole, the first surah of the first passage of the Quran, which is the 96th chapter, or surah, which means chapter for the Quran. And he came down and he spoke to his wife and he consulted with a Christian monk and found out this indeed was prophecy, this indeed was an angel. And this began his career of prophecy. But something that we need to understand that's different about the Quran than when we read the Tanakh is that this is over the career of just one man, one prophet, let's say, in their belief. And this prophet was interacting with different communities. He was interacting with pagans and with Jews and with Christians and different kinds of, and his own community. And revelations would come down as a conversation with specific scenarios. We would call them occasions of revelation. There's a whole literature that tries to take a Quranic verse and say, who was this revelation directed towards? And so it's kind of like reading meeting notes, but where you've only gotten one speaker, or if you've heard one half of a telephone conversation. And so it can be complicated, but we've taken some passages that have some familiar narratives. So if you can turn to the first page of our source sheet. And we'll start with a familiar midrash. Would someone read for me? From Breishit Rabbah, the, you know, Perek Lamed Chet. With a loud voice, yes, so our recordings can pick it up. Please, thank you.
And Haran died in the presence of his father, Terah, in Genesis 11:28. And Haran died in the presence of his father, Terah. Rav Chiya said, Terah was a manufacturer of idols. He once went away somewhere and left Abraham to sell them in his place. A man came and wished to buy one. How old are you? Abraham asked him. 50 years, was the reply. Woe to such a man, he exclaimed. You are 50 years old and would worship a day-old object? At this he became ashamed and departed. On another occasion, a woman came with a plateful of flour and requested of him, take this and offer it to them. So he took a stick, broke them, and put the stick in the hand of the largest. When his father returned, he demanded, what have you done to them? I cannot conceal it from you, he rejoined. A woman came with a plateful of fine meal and requested me to offer it to them. One claimed, I must eat first, while another claimed, I must eat first. Thereupon the largest arose, took the stick, and broke them. Why do you make sport of me? He cried out. Have they then any knowledge? Should not your ears listen to what your mouth is saying? He retorted. Thereupon he seized him and delivered him to Nimrod.
Excellent reading. Maybe you'll continue and read the next passage. We'll have the recording. We'll have both of these texts side by side, and then we can talk about them and refer to the pages in front of us.
From Quran 21:51 to 68. And we have verily given Abraham of his good guidance, And we are aware of him.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, that the we may be striking to someone who's not familiar with the Quran. We is the royal we, the rexus pluralis, where God refers to God's self as we did this. So just like we might think about plural names for God in the Torah, was there a background of many gods that came to be a monotheism? Different discussion. As far as we're concerned, this is just God.
Oh, I'll start over. And we had verily given Abraham of his good guidance, and we were aware of him. When he said unto his father and his folk, what are these images to which you are devoted? They said, we found our fathers worshipped them. He said, verily, you and your fathers were in plain error. And by Allah, I shall circumvent your idols after you have gone away and turned your backs. Then he reduced them to fragments, all save the largest of them, that they might have recourse to it. They said, who has done this to our gods? Surely it must be some evildoer. They said, we heard a youth make mention of them, who is called Abraham. They said, then bring him before the people's eyes that they may testify. They said, is it you who has done this to our gods, O Abraham? He said, but this, their chief has done it. So question them if they can speak. And they were utterly confounded, and they said, thou knowest well that they speak not. He said, do you then worship instead of Allah that which cannot profit you at all, nor harm you? Fie on you and all that you worship instead of Allah. Have you then no sense? They cried, burn him and stand by your gods if you will be doing.
Poetic language translation is always a complicated question. I actually like a translation that keeps some of the challenging nature of the Quranic language. There are those that translate in a more plain spoken English. But here you see it's the same narrative with some details different. We could look at the terms and compare and tease out some of the differences. But what I want us to talk about is that this is a similar narrative, similarly employed. This is a young Abraham being called to faith. The other midrash that many might be familiar with, Abraham looking at the moon and the stars and coming through cogitation, through reason, to a belief in God, also finds a place in the Quran in one of the stories of Abraham and in Ibrahim, in his mentioning. And there's something very simple here that, to me, I use this text because it raises the question for me. And it demonstrates it very well. How did this get in here? I come in with the assumption that the Midrash is historically earlier. It came from a context that was earlier, but within the same time period. How did it get there? And there are a few different theories. We're talking about this in the historical lens as a historian, and historians do have a few different notions of how this may have occurred. One would be that there were converts to early Islam from Judaism. Two very prominent converts, Ka'b al-Akhbar, Wahab ibn Munabbih, are two names that come up of people who brought lots and lots of biblical and midrashic materials with them. And people, when they wanted to use a biblical story, would turn to these knowing Jews and say, well, what was it about this guy? But that raises the question for me that comes beforehand. Why would these even be in the Quran itself? And this is part of how Muhammad viewed his mission as a prophet, a monotheistic prophet like those along the lines of those of the Hebrew Bible, of the New Testament. Jesus comes into the Quran as well as a prophet, not as a son of God, a very important point that's repeated again and again, Jesus as a prophet. And there is a certain amount of authority that comes in claiming the Hebrew Bible. When we talk about early Jewish-Christian relations, it's not dissimilar to the debates about whether the Hebrew Bible should be a part of the Christian narrative. Marcionites, an early Christian sect, wanted to argue that Christians should be cutting off from those stories. But ultimately, they were moving enough and inspiring enough and important as an authorizer for the new religion that they stayed in. And so Muhammad's mission very much is as a part of this. So Abraham is a model for him in some ways of someone in a pagan society who came out and was smashing the idols of ideology and maybe even literally the idols physically of what was around him. So the converts to Islam, early Jewish converts to Islam, that's one theory. Another theory is, no, they weren't converts, but the early movement was one that included Jews and Christians. And one of the earliest documents that's not in the Quran is known as the Constitution of Medina. Our earliest recorded versions are about 100 years later, but scholars analyzing the language of it do believe that it probably comes from the time, from this time, the same time as the Quran. And it talks about a confederation of Jewish, Christian, and this, they wouldn't say Muslim at that time, the tribe of believers, of followers of Muhammad, and that there was even a clause that said they have their religion and we have our religion. So maybe this was part of actually some kind of confederation in this little Arabian town. But again, to remember what Arabia is, this is not Jerusalem, this is not Pumpedita, this is not Nahardai, this is not the Jewish centers where we find the Talmud. Sure, the Bavli is in the Persian Empire and the Yerushalmi is mostly in the Byzantine Empire. They're different cultures, but this is far off from both of them. So what would it look like if we were to imagine a religion being founded today? There's no technology for communication. There's no text message, email, or the internet. But someone is trying to found a Judaism, or is trying to found a religion based on the Judaism and Christianity of Anchorage, Alaska, and the local needs of Anchorage, Alaska. Well, some of it would look like what we're familiar with. Some of it would not. I don't know whether Maimonides would be familiar with it or not, for those who were at the panel last night, or whether he would daven in that shul, but there are going to be some resonances. So the idea that there was a confederation of ideas here is another theory. Another theory is that there were Christian and Jewish missionaries out there and heretics. Those who went to Arabia were those who had to escape the centers. And so they brought, and even traders, this was along trade routes, but somehow these stories traveled as edifying educational tales, maybe campfire stories we could imagine them as. And this speaks to the oral context. And here there is great overlap with what we know of and what we think about for the Talmud and Midrashim at the time. They were not written down during the 6th and 7th century. They were compiled at that point, but they were probably not written down and distributed in the form that we have them now. Certainly not with Rashi, Tosfos, and all the Mefarshim in the back. And so in both of these contexts, we're talking about an oral transference of ideas. And to imagine the fluidity of an oral context, ideas are passed from person to person and not through a book that one reads or necessarily in formal institutions. So it's possible that this was not something that either Jews brought in through their conversion to Islam or that Jews brought in through conversation, but just that this was somehow in the air. These were stories of biblical figures. They may have come in that way. These are some of the questions that historians ask when we find similar Jewish narrative materials and even ritual practices that are in Islam. And those differences may tell us either that there were different versions of Midrashim out there, perhaps, or that there were active choices that the early Muslim community made to define themselves in some way different from the stories that were out there. The next lens I want to turn to is the interfaith lens, and for this one, it seems fitting. Turn the page in your source sheet, and you have the 37th chapter of the Quran, and we're going to be talking about the story of the near sacrifice of Abraham's beloved son, what we would call the Akedah. And this comes after another retelling of the same Abraham and Terach story, and it picks up in, let's say, in, would someone read from 99 to 113? Please, for those listening on the recording, you'll have a nice dialogue of voices here, so I appreciate that.
I'll do the English side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to read in the Arabic.
And he said, I am going to my Lord, he will guide me.
That's Abraham.
Lord, grant me a righteous child. So we announced to him the good news of a prudent boy. Then, when he attained the age of consorting with him, he said, My son, I have seen in sleep that I am slaughtering you. See what you think. He said, My father, do what you are commanded. You will find me, Allah willing, one of the steadfast. Then when they both submitted and he flung him down upon his brow, and we called out to him, O Abraham, you have believed the vision. Thus we reward the beneficent. This indeed is the manifest trial. And we ransomed him with a large sacrifice, and we left him with him for later generations. Peace be upon Abraham. Thus we reward the beneficent. He is indeed one of our believing servants. And we announced to him the good news of Isaac as a prophet, one of the righteous. And we blessed him and blessed Isaac. And of their progeny, some are beneficent and some are wronging themselves manifestly.
Great, thank you. So what is one thing that you notice here about the story that I think is very familiar out there, but who is the sacrifice? Who is the child that was seen in Abraham or Ibrahim's sleep to be slaughtered? I heard Isaac and I heard Ishmael. So it's interesting, and because it won't necessarily be picked up by the mic, I'll explain. There are actually both readings. Both readings are possible. And the reading that would be in favor of Isaac would say, that the story started, if you look in verse 100, Lord, grant me a righteous child. And it ended that we blessed him with Isaac, a righteous child. That was his progeny. He asked for it. And so it's a coda going back and telling me this was the person that we were talking about the whole time. And that it happens, ein mukdamu me'uchar, but let's read this in a poetic way. The other reading would say, no, this, let's read it chronologically. The story happened, a child was sacrificed, and then, as a result of that manifest trial that Abraham passed, he was granted this righteous child, Isaac the younger. And both readings are possible, and if you turn the page in the source sheet, I've given you one of the early compilers of oral traditions, a compiler of Quranic midrashim. We would call them hadith, oral reports. And he says, this is at the top, and on his saying, and we ransomed him, Fadaina, with a mighty sacrifice, and we ransomed Ishak, Isaac, with a mighty sacrifice. And fidya means ransom, replacement. God is saying we ransomed him in that we replaced sacrificing him with a great ram, and we saved him from death. And the men of great interpretation have disagreed about which of the sons of Ibrahim were ransomed from sacrifice, and some of them say it was Ishak, and others say it was Ismail. And the truth is, this is very early on. At some point in the history of Quranic interpretation, Ishmael becomes the dominant Orthodox position. You don't hear many people picking up the Isaac tradition. And some of the reasons for that is a turning away from needing to rely on Jewish narratives, and a self-definition that is a parting of ways that pushes against that and embraces an Arabian heritage, and Ishmael being that forefather in a way. But I always get a little tickled by this because, as yeshiva students, I think on the previous story, that of Avraham and Terach, there are young yeshiva students that if you ask them about the story of the smashing of the idols, they would say, sure, that's in Bereshit, that's in the text of the Torah. But then, you point out, you say, no, that's really a midrash, but we teach it so hand in glove that it's in people's minds. Sometimes when I teach this to multi-faith groups with Muslims among them, they, and I'll introduce the story and say it could be both. They say, no, the Quran says it was Ismail. They say, point out the verse that says that to me. And it's surprising to some people because it is taught so much in that way. We're a little short on time, and I want to make sure that we're moving. The text in Genesis Rabbah, Midrash Rabbah, Bereshit, Perek Nun Hey, shows some of this Yitzchak Yishmael competition happening in the mouth of the Midrashim. So I don't want you to think that it's just Islam that is wrestling with these questions. We also have this question of Avraham's sons. Yishmael also gets Birkat Avraham, gets a great blessing to be a great nation of 12 tribes, by the way, to think about the parallelism that happens with our own tradition as well. And there's, as an interfaith professional, I want to ask the question, what does this do for me? What does this do for me? And another challenge, you know, on the one hand, I think that having a shared story, even if we disagree about the details, means we have something to talk about. We can come to the table, and there's a certain amount of pride among Muslim communities of this shared story, although, you know, details are different. But that therein also lies one of the challenges. What do you make of the fact, if you believe that your text is completely true, what do you make of the fact that someone else has different details? So I think here, a lot of us as Orthodox Jews would get into the, we're right, you're wrong, we came before, you changed this version of the story, let's look back at history. And in the Quran and in Islamic theology, and this is in the history of polemics, there's a theory that's developed known as tahrif or tabdil, adulteration or substitution, that somehow we as Jews were not proper keepers of our texts through whether intentionally or accidentally through our exiles. So the version of the Torah that we have in our hands is not the same one given to Moses at Sinai. And this would account for some of the differences. It would also account in medieval Muslim-Jewish polemics, it also accounts for why there's no mention of Muhammad in the Torah. I think that this is a major challenge that also is wrapped up with a blessing. And it's one of the things that I think is much more complicated about Muslim-Jewish dialogue than about Christian-Jewish dialogue. Because in Christian-Jewish dialogue, we share a text, and we share the version of that text with some differences, but our question is about interpretation. We have rabbinic tradition, and then there's the New Testament, and these are different reception histories. Here, there's a community that is so interwoven with interpretation, and in this discussion that we have to figure out, what do you do when someone believes that they know you, but it's not the you that you know yourself? And I think that it's an important thing because we can come to the table and have discussion, and there is motivation, fuel for that conversation, but there's an opportunity to say, this is who I am and this is what I believe. I'm not telling you what you should believe, but there needs to be a reckoning of what it means when you come to the table and say, I know who you are as a Jew, and I know Abraham, and I know Moses, and I know all of this, But it's not who you think you are. And one of the cardinal rules of interfaith dialogue that we have is you don't get to define the beliefs of the other party. I don't get to come to the table and say, this is what I believe my partner, my dialogue interlocutor should believe about Israel, about God, about political or theological issues. You come to the table and you have a discussion. When there have to be commonalities, either shared concerns, in this case we're saying shared narratives, that brings us to the table. But we have to not be scared of difference. And we have to be comfortable and confident naming those differences. There's a lot on the notion of interfaith relations and polemics and competition, and the discussion about how this comes into active conversation about issues that we care about, rather than about theology that matters to us, is a wonderful discussion and not the one we're having this morning. But I'll stick around afterwards if there are folks who want to initially get into that. Let's skip the Quranic passage from the second chapter, verses 125 to 30. This is another Ishmael tale where Ibrahim and Ismail build the Kaaba, they build the center in Mecca. There's a whole conversation about the geography of biblical stories. Did the Akedah happen in Arabia, or did it happen in Eretz Yisrael? And this is also connected, I think, in some ways to our differing versions of details of the narratives. And again, I don't see these as reasons not to have a discussion. I see these as wonderful differences that open up conversations for us. But again, looking back to our shared narratives, this is very much a point of difference that we need to reckon with. If you turn the page to the page with our New Yorker cartoon, gentleman on a horse going to war saying, I hear it's because we're right and they're wrong. we come to our section where we ask, what does it mean for me as a Jew? And of course, we have not done justice to either of the previous two lenses, nor will we for this one, but I hope I'm stirring the pot in your mind to read more, and I can recommend wonderful readings in each of these areas. And I think as an Orthodox Jew, this is a challenging question. For me, in my yeshiva education, I grew up in Jewish day schools, Jewish summer camps. Most of my friends were Jewish, if not all. And I didn't really think about other religions as something that had to do with my own practice. And my meaning-making structure, my basic foundation of discourse for how I understood the world and still how I understand the world is through the lens of Torah and is through the lens of our very rich tradition of structuring our lives through halakha, through ideas, through these narratives. But being across the table from someone who believes and practices differently and studying the traditions of others, especially where they overlap and even where they differ, for me, as someone who cares about my religion, it necessarily forces me to ask, what does this mean for me as a Jew? So take a moment just in your head, as you've engaged this morning a little bit. Is it walled off, or is there a piece of you that wants to know, does this make me ask any questions about myself? And maybe I'll ask you to step up again, thank you, and read from the Talmud Bavli in Yoma Chafchet, Amud Bet.
Rav said, our father Abraham kept the whole Torah, as it is said, because that Abraham hearkened to my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws, from Bereishit 26:5. Rav Shimi Barchia said to Rav, say perhaps that this refers to the seven laws of Noah. Surely there was also that of circumcision. Then say that it refers to the seven laws and circumcision and not to the whole Torah. If that were so, why does Scripture say, my commandments and my laws? Rabbah or Rav Ashi said, Abraham, our father, kept even the law concerning the Eruv of the dishes, as it is said, my Torahs, one being the written Torah and the other the oral Torah.
So this maybe is a midrash also that you were familiar with, that all of the Avot and Imahot kept the entire Torah right up to Eruv Tafshilin. And someone might disagree. It seems like Rav and Rav Ashi might disagree. They might have said they see this in the verses of the Torah. When I read Bereishit and I'm sitting in shul, I don't see this practice there in the text itself, right? This is a midrash. And possibly one that came up in conversation with Christianity. I could have put the text from Galatians, I believe it's chapter 3 in the New Testament, although it's not the only reference by far, that says Abraham was saved. Abraham was beloved of God a good 400 years before, or 200 years before there was a Torah. And so I know that you don't need laws to be saved and beloved by God. And so there may be perhaps a reaction that says, or a conversation that says, no, he did. He did keep the Torah. That was part of his practice. It's a way of looking back and saying, my religion is unchanging. Now, it's interesting that that same polemical argument that comes up in the New Testament to critique and in some ways undermine, we might say, part of a supersession of the law of Torah is used also against Christians as well in the Quran. And maybe you'll read the next chapter for us in the Quran, chapter 3, verses 64 to 70.
Say, O people of the book, come to common terms as between us and you, that we worship none but Allah, that we associate no partners with him, and that we erect not from ourselves lords and patrons other than Allah. Then we turn back, say ye, bear witness that we, at least submitters to Allah's will. O people of the book, why do you dispute about Abraham when the law and the gospel were not revealed until after him? Have you no understanding? Ah, you are those who dispute in matters of which you had some knowledge. But why do you argue in matters of which you have no knowledge? It is Allah who knows and you who know not. Abraham was not a Jew nor yet a Christian, but he was faithful, Hanif, and submitting, Muslim, and he joined not gods with Allah. Without doubt, among men, the nearest of kin to Abraham are those who follow him, and also this prophet and those who believe, and Allah is the protector of those who have faith. It is the wish of a section of the people of the book to lead you astray, but they shall lead astray not you, but themselves, and they do not perceive. Ye people of the book, why reject ye the signs of Allah, of which ye are yourselves witnesses?
This is not the only articulation of this kind of argument, but it is a good one, and it's also very interesting that it starts out by saying, let's come to common terms, the things that we believe in common, a single God and good works and some of that. But don't you know that if we all believe in Abraham as our founding father, there was no gospel at the time. There was no Torah at the time. So don't you know he was a lowercase m, Muslim, submitter to God. And this is the practice that we have. So let's come to common terms about that. It's a really interesting argument, I think. And I guess I have to recognize that I sit with the study of Muslim-Jewish relations and polemics for as a living, I guess. And it's not something that makes me uncomfortable because there's Jewish polemical tracts that are against Islam, fewer because of their position at the time, but there are those that are written in that direction as well. I don't think polemics, verbal polemics, which is one community arguing about the beliefs of another for jockeying for truth and righteousness, I don't think that that necessarily equals violence. I don't think that that necessarily equals enmity or hatred. In some ways, sometimes you're speaking to your own community to justify their beliefs against an outside threat or a feeling of minority, which the Muslim community in the early relations certainly was a minority community that did not have a history at that time and was trying to establish its own identity. This makes very good sense to me for a new religion that is trying to shape its way. It's not unlike, at least in my mind, the way that some of our earliest texts talk about Kna'anim and other religions that were around at the time. We had to distinguish ourselves from them. We believed that we were bringing something new to the world, and that necessarily comes with what we would call differentiation. I'm not saying that these texts cannot be used in a way to build enmity and hatred, but they don't have to be used that way. That's back in the interfaith lens, and we can argue and dispute about that, and I'm not trying to be an apologist. I think they are used that way sometimes in the world today. But as a Jew, and this is something I like about polemics, I like engaging in conversations in my mind with someone who would attack my beliefs, with someone who wants to dispute with me, and someone who wants to question the foundations of things that I take for granted, because I think it sharpens and strengthens who I am. I think debate internally and externally helps us to do that when it's done civilly and with a certain amount of respect. And so I ask the question, are there things that I can learn? And for me, I'll put it up front, this is the answer is obvious. I learn a tremendous amount from the history of Muslim-Jewish relations. I learn a great deal about Rambam in reading his Arabic writing and looking at the terms that he uses and seeing them used in Islamic law and comparing those ideas. I learn a tremendous amount from the Golden Age of Spain and seeing the ideas in philosophy and language and the very foundations of the study of Hebrew grammar and language come in conversation with the studies of Arabic. The words themselves, the languages were in contact. Most of Rambam's writings were in Arabic, Sadia Gaon, others. We have to remember that there was a whole history where the field of discourse that Jews were living in, probably one of the most formative epics for our people, that of the Gaonim and through the times of the Rambam, they were thinking in what we would call not Islamic, but Islamicate discourse. So here in English, we might use the term scripture or prayer or grace, perhaps, and they have meaning that they carry in the English language, and by looking at the way that they're out there in the world, we can understand something about how we as Jews use them in our context. This is true for Arabic as well. But on the question of Abraham, this verse, or these verses, and this conversation makes me ask the question, what do I believe? What was it that Avraham was doing? I mean, we're here, we just started the Abraham cycle in our Parshiot. We're going to be spending a lot of weeks thinking about Avraham. It's why I chose him as the example rather than Moshe or any of the other 20 figures that appear in the Quran. What was it he was bringing to the world? Was it Erev Tafshilin? Was it Mila? Was it Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, some kind of natural law? And sure, when I read this Quranic verse, there are pieces of me that are uncomfortable. But then there's also the piece that steps back and says, wow, I grew up thinking about us as this tiny people that were the kickball of history, being tossed around from country to country without trying to survive, scramble and live where we lived and just to maintain our beliefs. But this forces me to zoom out and to say, this Avraham, this founding father that we have, is embraced by, as I said in that joke, a good third, quarter, or the third of the world's population. And it means something that if we look at the Tanakh and you read some of the work there, there was only one group that was carrying the mantle of monotheism. And if you look at the world of Torah, it wasn't likely that they were going to be successful. Sure, there's a messianic age where all nations are going to come and say, Ki beiti beit tefila l'chol ha'amim. But it wasn't going to happen before then. It wasn't going to happen before then. And I'm not saying that we're living in a messianic age. But for me, as a Jew, it makes me pause and gives me a sense of pride to say, look at this belief system. This person who brought a belief in one God, who cares about the human action, who wants to have an interaction and a relationship with Jews, who is a carrier of ethical content. We might debate about some of the specifics of that, but generally a shared ethic. And this is something that we brought to the world. And I think that studying these texts side by side can teach us things. They should make us uncomfortable, and they should. But in that discomfort, we shouldn't close off that place of us that can also learn and can also cultivate a sense of pride, a sense of newness, of renewedness. And that's some of what I take from these. Do we want to take a couple of questions, or? The microphone. Yeah. And we can take two at a time and then.
Yeah, take two at a time, the 80 seconds.
So, Ari, the question I have is chronology. Mm-hmm. The Jewish religion goes back to 1200 BC, 1300 BC. We have a tradition that continued for another 1900 years before Muslim even appeared on the map. How do you take a religion that appears 1900 years later and accept that the twists and the turns that they have with respect to Ishmael and with respect to some of our own traditions could have any merit or integrity?
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a personal question. You said that it strengthens your faith. I heard you say now, yes, it strengthens our pride, but how does it strengthen your faith?
So, in 80 seconds, I would say to the first question that this comes from a notion of narrative, of looking at the way that stories are told and the way they manifest meaning in the lives of people that is not the same as analytic philosophy. And it's not the same as a reconstruction of positivist history. Because if we're talking as historians, biblical critics and the historians of religion, always have doubt and always have skepticism about the versions of stories that people are telling themselves. And so if you want to find the earliest versions of Sifrei Torah, they're far after the events of those versions happened. I don't think those questions for us as people of faith are the right ones to be asking. They are the right ones for historians to ask, and we can learn from them. But in terms of this conversation about shared narratives, it's a different kind of question. And we can talk more about it. I imagine that's not fully satisfying. In terms of personally how it strengthens my faith, I guess I'll start by just saying, to me, it feels good that not to be alone. To me, it feels good that it's not just us in the world that are wrestling with some of these questions and that are learning from some of these figures. And so at moments, I'm very troubled by it, but in good moments, in those moments where I would say my faith is strengthened, I feel bolstered by the world of religion and the diversity of religions that we live in. And I recognize that that is fully a 21st century North American Jewish thing to say, living in a multicultural society where we can freely practice and where we sit together with others. And in a way that if I study Marxism or other secular ideologies in college, that's far more threatening than studying other faiths. Knowing that we're not just carrying this torch alone, but that there are people for whom religion and revelation and even some of these shared revelations are meaning-making and enriching, to me, that's very supportive. Thank you.